In 2007, four people vanished. It was dubbed a death cult. But after months of investigation, I don't think it's that simple. I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nanup 4, a story of people drawn into a 20-year saga they didn't ask for, who have spent decades trying to reconcile the choices they made that led them here.
The family lived a bizarre alternative lifestyle.
Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Well, where are women at today, both here in Australia and around the world? Well, hello, I'm Justine Toe. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National. I'm guest presenting this special edition of God Forbid leading up to International Women's Day. It is so great to be back in the chair. But as I survey the state of womanhood today, the horrors of Jeffrey Epstein continue to dominate the news cycle. The manosphere clogs social media with misogyny, and online harassment of women is at a peak. The PM has stumbled into a mess of his own making, calling advocate and abuse survivor Grace Tame difficult. What are we to make of all this? Ginger Gorman is a visiting fellow at Julia Gillard's Global Institute for Women's Leadership at ANU, the author of Troll Hunting: Inside the World of Online Hate and Its Human Fallout. Great to have you here, Ginger.
Thank you so much for having me.
We also are joined by Naomi Kanangara, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the International Women's Development Agency. Nice to have you here, Naomi.
Thank you for having me, Justine.
Now, Ginger Gorman, politics, online culture, media, what's the vibe? Are women's rights going backwards or does it feel like that?
I'm going to answer that question, but I just want to pay my respects to our First Nations matriarchs and their knowledges and care for country. I want to raise a glass to all the difficult women like Grace Tame. Thank God for them, because if they weren't around and if they hadn't been in our past, we wouldn't have made any progress at all. You are absolutely right in that we are in a very strange moment, in that misogynistic views that once felt very fringe are now becoming mainstream. So organized misogyny is really normalized. The manosphere is shaping boys' attitudes, and certainly young girls are growing up thinking or expecting that they're going to be harassed offline and online. And, you know, there's this documented global decline in women's political participation and also just in public life. And we're seeing unprecedented threats, coordinated disinformation campaigns, and it's happening under the guise of moralities. Roe versus Wade, which was the 1973 Supreme Court finding in the US that women had a constitutional right to abortion, that was rolled back. And so there's this feeling that women's autonomy is negotiable again, and gendered violence is also escalating. So we're seeing all these kinds of leaders minimizing women's suffering, and that is a scary reflection of this culture we're living in right now. And I would say it is a bit of a crisis point, although there are lots of touch points for hope as well.
Yes, we'll get into the hope. We'll need a bit of hope. We'll need more than a bit of hope.
Yes, that's right.
But like on top of everything you've just listed there, I want to talk about Jeffrey Epstein and the Epstein story, because that story just continues to reverberate. And honestly, I've got the Gisèle Pelicot story in the background as well. Why do you think cases like this feel so symbolic of something far bigger going on here?
So it's easy to slip into despair, and it certainly does feel like we're sliding backwards in some ways. But if we look at the Epstein files and also the Gisèle Pelicot case, these are cases obviously which have primarily happened in Western countries, but they are reverberating around the world. I do want to fully acknowledge the horror of these stories. There's absolutely no facing up to these stories without feeling physically ill. And in fact, a lot of the women I know can't read the detail, especially people like myself. You know, if you've got kids of the age of the children, especially girls that have been abused on Epstein Island, it's very hard to face up to this stuff. The detail is just so horrendous. But if we can just park that for a second in all its horror, there's something else really important going on, which is that none of these cases would have come to light and would be so scorned and so high profile even a decade ago. So the shame is no longer staying with the victims. The shame is actually, and the consequences are now actually being placed back, not on the women, not on the victims, but on the men, that mainly men, you know, we have characters like Ghislaine Maxwell, but mainly on the male perpetrators that did this. And so it's really important that we see someone like Jeffrey Epstein, although he's now dead, go to jail, or Prince Andrew being arrested, because it tells us that these men are not impenetrable. These patriarchal power structures actually can be attacked, they can be criticized, and they are not going to last forever. So this shows us that feminism and the work that we are doing is important, and it's hard, but it is having an impact.
Yeah. Naomi,
I agree with that wholeheartedly. I mean, there is a marked difference between 10 years back, and I attribute that strongly, among many other things, to the movements like Me Too that really shifted the way that we talk about, understand, and share information about what's happening to women, how sexual abuse in particular is experienced. And as Ginger was saying, it used to be a private, personal, shameful experience. And oftentimes women not knowing what's happening to them is happening to a lot of others as well. So because of the movements like Me Too, what has changed is that it has changed from personal to revealing. It is actually systemic. It's happening across the countries, the regions, the world. And even now, what we are also finding out is that the systems are not doing what they're supposed to.
Yeah.
And there are massive gaps in the way that these literally man-made systems in holding perpetrators of crimes against women. So we are in this kind of one of those fundamental moments.
Naomi, can I ask you, do you think that part of this shift is actually women speaking out with their stories, and that's a burden that's put on us, but speaking to each other and hearing each other's stories, and that's part of where the power is coming from, like the unwillingness to be silent, I guess, is what I'm talking about.
Spot on. So culturally, as you know very well, Ginger, there is this framing that women gossip, women hate each other, women pull down each other. These kind of cultural framings that we see in multiple formations across the world have been keeping women in isolation, not knowing what's happening to them is happening to others, not receiving information from others, kind of revealing what's happening is it's a part of a system that keeps women in that place, wants the woman to provide the unpaid, harmful services she often provides to keep the system going. She's a peg in a system that is not there, put in place in her best interest, right? As much as I have many hesitations as a mother of a young child in the way that social media is presenting itself, it has been a blessing for the gender equality movements in much more than in one way. Right now, the conversations that are happening across the globe, the way that women are sharing, people are holding the governments to account, is all related to that chatter, those conversations. I mean, for example, even in the Jeffrey Epstein case, what is keeping that alive is the public. When the systems are not doing what it's supposed to, the people who are responsible are held to account by the movements, the public, the individuals. And I see this as a glimpse of a silver lining in this very dark situation.
Well, Naomi, I want to talk, give us fly us over the Asia Pacific region and give us a sense of how women are faring. Like what are things happening right now for them? What are they most concerned about? Is it like male violence, economic insecurity, climate disaster? What sorts of things are they grappling with?
All of the above. And what has been at the front line is the women and their movements consisting of women's rights organizations on the ground. Justine, the progress that we have seen, at times two steps forward, one step back, and at times leaps ahead, is all due to the women who are sharing what's happening to them on the ground, organizing themselves from grounds up, and having allies in the regions, in countries like Australia, investing in the work that they're doing. I mean, Australia has been and continue to be a formidable ally in the gender equality work that is happening across our regions, particularly Indo-Pacific, Asia-Pacific region, at a time that what used to be the guardians of the international rights-based system, when those guardians are withdrawing themselves, cutting funds, weaponizing funding systems, Australia has been doing the right thing. We, even when the US governmental policy changed their stance, we came up with our international gender equality strategy. Even in very tough financial situations, we are keeping steady with our commitment to the region, holding a steady line when it comes to the investments through the aid budget. Obviously, there are many things that can improve. We continue to advocate to the Australian government to do better, step up, and be a stronger and better ally to the work that's happening. That's one side. But the other factor is, unfortunately, most Australians feel that gender equality is already there, because we see that to some extent in Australia. You know, for the first time in the recorded history, we have equity in the Australian Parliament. Amazing. And we see women's voices, women in leadership, women in business. But that is not actually the kind of reflection that we see across the world. And also in Australia, if you look at different statistics like gender-based violence and discrimination and the experience of migrant and other women who are in the margins and corners of the communities, we are nowhere near gender equality. Not only a lot of work to be done, a long distance to go, but now there are fundamental barriers in front of us in the form of not having the resources to do that. So that's the state of where things are, yes.
The state of play, yeah. Perhaps another example of how women don't have the same opportunities, or they're not as free from discrimination as we would like them to be, is the manosphere, right? Digital misogyny. Ginger, you're the expert here. Tell me, like, this is something that is turbocharged by tech companies, right? And they're having an effect on our democracy, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, I want to link my answer back to what Naomi just said. You know, it's easy to look at Parliament or something perhaps and think, you know, this bunch of mainly white women, middle-class white women, you know, there's an equal number of them to men and things are equal. But that isn't the case. It's not in the case in the Asia Pacific, it's not the case in First Nations communities, and it's not the case in, say, the domestic violence sector, and it's not the case online, right? So it's not the case that you look online and everybody gets an equal place to talk. It's a place of extremist, misogynistic radicalization. And I remember the first time I spoke about this at Senate hearings in 2018, and I described this type of misogyny as extremism. The people on that Senate committee looked at me like I'd lost my mind, like I was absolutely crackers. But it is a form of extremism, and we are seeing the harms from that unfolding before our eyes. And if you can imagine the kind of emergency sirens, that's where we're up to. So we're seeing radicalized men like incels and this surge in male loneliness, hard right patriarchy. It's all on this spectrum. And then these are blokes responding to what they perceive as the threat of gender equality, this huge backlash, and they are scrambling to defend these really old power structures. And these are power structures that actually don't serve them anyway, serve men. So I find that fascinating as well, because these power structures harm men as much or more than women. It damages them. You know, it makes them more lonely. It makes them more subject to violence. They're more likely to die earlier, etc. And you are absolutely right that the platforms are not just fueling this ecosystem. They're making heaps of money from it. That's the first thing. That's their revenue base. But they are proliferating the radicalization, and it's kind of increasing because of their algorithms. So it's vulnerable boys vulnerable men that are getting wound into this radicalization. And what we know from decades of evidence is that dehumanization, in this case of women, leads to real life harm and violence in the end. We, you know, we're seeing this. We're seeing rising rates of domestic abuse, rising rates of women in politics and so forth, subject to this kind of online and offline violence. They're leaving politics. And the bottom line is that the platforms are not just conduits, they actually need to be held accountable. So there's no other publisher. Like, imagine if the ABC was broadcasting that kind of extremism. We couldn't, right? So we've got to ask these questions about why we are allowing private companies to harm us so much. Why are they allowed to make money out of women getting harmed and killed and misogynist extremism? It's a really important question about regulation.
Yeah.
And we're not going to see reduced domestic abuse, reduced harm of women, reduced harm from especially intersectional women and LGBTI people. We're not going to see that until these folks are unable to publish this kind of extremist hate speech online with impunity.
Yeah, wow, the work is cut out for us, isn't it? I mean, we've already started getting into like the meaty side of things, but let's kick it up a gear. So here's a totally uncontroversial, as in it is controversial, question for you both. What is a woman?
Naomi, you answer first. I've got a lot of thoughts about this, but I expect that you do too.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, for me, it's the way that a person experiences the world. A woman is defined by the environment that she's in and a set of experience that she lives through that is uniquely placed around her to ensure that she engages in the environment around her in a certain way. The womanhood is not necessarily in the body. The womanhood is in the experience.
Ginger?
So if we go back to online culture, and unfortunately I spent more time than I'd like to imbibing different kinds of hatred online because that's the basis of the work I do, we see this increasing polarization and increasing, it's part of the radicalization where people want to say there are only two genders, there's women and there's men. And it's egged on by people like J.K. Rowling who have very extremist views in these areas. But in the end, biological determinism is just too simplistic. So first of all, there's a significant percentage of the population who don't fit neatly into the XXXY categories, even before we talk about gender identity, right? Humans have always been more complicated than those two boxes. Like you get Indigenous Americans and they had seven genders, right? Way before, you know, colonization. So the insistence that there's men and there's women and a woman is this biological definition is just garbage. And it's actually about maintaining patriarchal order, like controlling who counts, who matters, who gets to reproduce, right? So it's not about biology, it's actually about patriarchy. And fear of difference drives backlash, especially when we start talking about trans women, gender diverse people, and them refusing to be invisible. So just back to what Naomi just said, exactly right. A woman is someone who knows herself to be a woman, and the world is just so much richer, not poorer, and it's not a threat when we hold that complexity and we allow for the richness of human experience.
Well, I have to admit, I don't know. I feel like the body does have something to say. And then I suppose this would put me in that biological determinism category. I'm not saying that all women who have wombs need to produce, you know, having kids, and that's what defines a woman. But it seems to me that things like International Women's Day, they seem like they're based on this idea that there are largely two kinds of humans, I suppose, in the world. And even if there are variation between the sexes, they largely fall into, well, there's a male type of body and the female type of body. I can appreciate the spirit of International Women's Day, wanting to be embracing, wanting to look for people who've been kind of pushed to the margins. But I'm just going to note that I have a slight disagreement with that. I don't think it's purely experience. I think experience has a lot to do with it, but I do think the body has something to say.
Can I just make a comment about International Women's Day? IWD Day Well, there are lots of arguments about how it started, but from what I understand, it started by migrant women basically raging against inequality and harm that was being done to them in the United States and being underpaid. And they were also fighting against child labor. And I just find International Women's Day hilarious because, in a kind of way, because it actually ignores all of that for the most part. It ignores who was fighting and what they were fighting for. And it makes it into this middle class white thing. And it's mostly labor that's put onto women, unpaid labor, on International Women's Day. Like, we're expected to find childcare for our kids and go to some stupid corporate breakfast.
Yeah, a breakfast.
At like 7 a.m. So it doesn't interrupt the patriarchal capitalist workday and then celebrate, in inverted commas, other women. I mean, Naomi's probably got stuff to say about this. Like, where are the culturally diverse voices and where's the childcare for them to actually celebrate or commemorate that day in its true spirit?
Well, the culturally diverse voices, two of them at least, are on this podcast. We've been taking the temperature and it's already hot where I am.
It is. Yeah, it is.
And I definitely want to make a comment, Ginger, about this relationship with women and their bodies, right? I mean, we are trying very hard in 2026 to take ourselves not just as we present ourselves in the bodies, but to take it to a different space. Mm-hmm. Women have been sexualized. We've been told what we can use the body for and not. Our autonomy is taken away. We have been all about our body for centuries, right? Mm. So this moment that we are in, we are saying we're much more than that. We have the experience that we are struggling with, the challenge with, and let's just move away from that conversation that we keep on coming back to again and again, because we actually have.
I mean, I will say, and this will be the final word on it, ladies, but like, Naomi, I feel like men have spent centuries fleeing from their bodies. And really what I want is for everyone to come back to the body, right? For men to realize their dependency, right? And the fact that they didn't just emerge from the ground. They actually were born from a woman. And that actually ties them into the human race, their embodiment. I hear what you're saying, that you don't want women just reduced to their bodies, but I think men equally need to be as reduced to the body as well. But anyway, I'm Justine Toe. It's God Forbid on ABC Radio National, the panel show about the things we believe and why we believe them. Journalist, author and broadcaster Ginger Gorman and CEO of the International Women's Development Agency, Naomi Kanangara, are my guests. And we're talking about where women are at in 2026. Now, back in the 1990s, American journalist Susan Faludi called the revolt against women's gains since the 70s a backlash. Is that still the right word? Now, Ginger, you often hear this phrase flying around. It's that feminism has, quote unquote, gone too far. Now, you started saying earlier about, you know, male loneliness, male vulnerability. Surely that is going to emerge as you think about this question.
I'm almost laughing because it's this kind of idea that women are too much or they've gone too far is so old and so boring. And it emerges when women make meaningful gains. We get this kind of dismissal. And it actually is almost a signal that we're on the right track, in my opinion. What it says is, patriarchy is feeling that the power is being threatened. So when old hierarchies feel really shaky, this sort of idea emerges that women are now over-empowered. And it reframes, you know, I'm sure you've all seen this. Whenever women are saying something in an online space, you get some muppet, like a male, he comes in and he says, what about men? Mm. Like if you're trying to report investigative stories about gendered violence and harm, you get these blokes coming in, what about us, right?
What about International Men's Day sort of thing? Yeah.
Yeah.
You get all the other days.
Yeah, we got our kids. Yeah, exactly. You've got every friggin' day of the week, dudes, like every single forever. So it reframes equality as a loss for men, which is a catastrophic error and mistake. So men still hold around the globe most of the political and economic power. Their voices are reported in the press the most, you know, they hold positions in parliaments, in businesses, etc. And it ignores this key truth. So inequality is not just sad for women and it doesn't just harm women, it harms everybody. And you were kind of talking about this, Justine, when you were talking about the body, right? It's not that it harms women and men are fine. It's actually catastrophic for men. So the mental health crisis we have right now, where men's suicide rates are increased, you know, they die from male violence more, their relationships break down, they have more addictions. I could go on forever. That is a direct result of rigid, toxic masculinity. So this rhetoric that, you know, equality's gone too far protects the status quo, not just at our expense,
yeah,
women's expense. It's saying no change is further needed. And why am I saying that? Because, like, it's actually, even if they were just doing it to be self-interested, it's worth their while because it's harming them. It's just such, it blows my mind when I think about this for too long. It's absolutely ridiculous.
I mean, it makes, I can hear that you find it ridiculous, and I find it ridiculous as well, but I will acknowledge that maybe it's just easier to stay with the devil you know. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't know what the future holds. And if all the energy feels very female, right, then there feels like there are gains. And meanwhile, you're looking around and who are your role models? You've got Andrew Tate and you like this girl, but you don't want to be accused of, like, I don't know, sexual assault or something. And maybe it's because we're in front of screens all the time. We don't know how to engage with each other properly in real life as well. So there's, I totally hear you. Like, why would men, like, just wanting to continue the system that hurts them? But I'm just like, I feel like if you know what, you only know what you know, right? You don't know what the possible gains are.
Well, it's a lack of critical thinking on all of our parts, but particularly men, and it's just indoctrination. And it's not indoctrination of something that helps them. That's the bonkers part of it.
Mm. Naomi, I want to hear from you about, like, young women especially.
So it is absolutely true that for generations now, women in smaller groups at the national level, at the global level, talking about issues like men's violence against women. And oftentimes, it's either been minimized and put in its place, dismissed, or at the best, what we hear men echoing is that not all men. Yes, that may be true, where women are saying, look, one in every three women experience this. This is not unique to one corner of our community. It's widespread. Women are being killed by their intimate partners on a regular basis. And this is at epidemic level. In that context, when we are talking about life or death situations, we are rallying about things like male loneliness, right? Mm. I mean, it's very interesting how, not to say one thing is true, the other thing is not, or one thing is more important than the other. It's just a reflection on how we as a society relate to issues when they're in front of us and how generations of patriarchal brainwashing has brought us to this moment. And this is why, going back to the paradigm shifting moment that we're experiencing with, you know, this global conversation happening around sexual abuse, is a revealing historical moment.
I feel like I need some help here because, you know, am I right in assuming that across the Asia Pacific, we're talking about more patriarchal societies, right? There's a particular kind of conversation that in the West we can have about Epstein, about sexual abuse, about sexual misconduct. But I'm wondering whether if you're in a more overtly patriarchal context, and I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, that the Asia Pacific might have more of those kinds of cultures, then the kinds of conversations that are possible about these issues have to be very careful. You've got to negotiate. You've got to step carefully. And sometimes you might have to, and I hate to say this, but you might have to settle almost for something that is good enough for now because the climate, the climactic conditions for a bigger conversation just aren't there.
We are more similar across the world than we are different. I mean, this kind of, okay, this is us and them. We are different to X, Y, and Z. We are borrowing it from this very colonial structured way of looking at the world.
Right. I was about to say a lot of this stuff in non-Anglo countries is actually a result of colonialism. Like, colonial systems have been brought into many countries, so it's not that they are innately more patriarchal or violent towards women. It's actually imported by colonialism.
Is that true though? Like, I don't know. I'm thinking, I mean, I might be the only one here who might dip into the Old Testament from time to time. And there's a lot of, like, you know, patriarchal stuff happening there, right? And it's not necessarily from the 18th, 19th century colonialism.
You're absolutely right, Justine, that at the heart of any culture is the religion that provides that framing, that political support to the, you know, the way that the society is governed and moves forward. And I'm a Buddhist myself, right? So I look at the way that the very patriarchal institution of Buddhism, again, run by men with women who are oppressed, rallying around the temple because there is no other source for comfort. There is no other form of guidance. And those guidance are extremely patriarchal serving, right? It's about how to dress, how to be, and to be silent, to give and to sacrifice, because there will be eternal reward, obviously. So there are many more similarities in the differences that we sit in, and they're all more or less is serving the system that we live in, which is very patriarchal.
I will observe that, you know, I mean, as a Christian myself, you know, Christianity is often seen as pure patriarchy. But it's funny because the writer Dorothy L. Sayers once described Jesus as someone who, quote unquote, took women seriously, which sounds like a low bar in a way. but I think what she meant was that he listened to them. He kind of like really, you know, was interested in having them engage with him in a way and to come back at him as well. So I'm hopeful that all these abuses of sexism are deformations.
And that's how I look at my spirituality as well. I separate the institution of Buddhism, for example, from the spiritual truth and the spirituality of it, which I sit in.
Now, I am a product of second wave feminism, right? Like I wanted to have a career. Becoming a mother was not my like must do, but I became a mother. So second wave feminism freed women like myself to go to work, but now I never stop working. And I'm always exhausted. And it takes two incomes to like service a mortgage. And I'm one of the lucky ones, right, who can afford to have a house. But then there's also this persistent care and mental load gap between men and women. And then all these horror stories out of the childcare sector mean that if I was still needing childcare for my kids, I would actually be very wary of putting them in one. So without going full trad wife, and I put that disclaimer in very clearly, how do we make sense of what women have gained and also what we might have lost or we're not so happy about as well?
Oh, I have so much to say about this. I feel like I need a little soapbox and an hour to speak about this. So I feel like it really does deserve a show on its own. And actually, I'm writing my next book at the moment and it includes a lot of the way that particularly middle class women are sandwiched in this exhaustion of work and caring for teens and caring for elderly parents and mental load and on we go. Second wave feminism did open paid work to women, as you're saying, but we never dismantled the expectations at home. So women ended up both doing wage labour and all the domestic labour and then other types of invisible labour. What do they call it? Man-keeping, I think the New York Times is calling it recently, and emotional labour. So the economic pressures are structural. And you're right. Like I'm a single parent with a huge mortgage and I ostensibly have to earn the amount that two regular people would earn to keep that all afloat.
Gosh.
And then if you have kids with extra needs, et cetera, like you're just drowning, right? And at one point I had this list of which I'd kept from when I was married. I'm no longer married. I had two small kids and married, and I had this list of everything I did that was unpaid and everything that I did was paid. And I put it into ChatGPT recently and I said to it, can you tell me how many hours a week I was working at that point? It was 115 hours a week.
You're working two jobs.
Yeah, and it's
full-time.
More than that. And it said you would be exhausted all the time and you are working 7 days a week. I don't think I'm anyone special. I think there's a lot of women doing that. And maybe even more if they've got caring for elderly parents. So we've gained opportunity, but we never, ever rest. And you're right, the answer is not the trad wife. The answer is redesigning the system so that care is shared and women are not enslaved by the domestic and mental load, as well as needing to bring in money. And until we see that equality of mental and domestic load that is shared, and also in same-sex marriages or partnerships, you know, we are never, ever, ever going to be really equal.
Naomi, anything to contribute?
A lot, yes. Mm-hmm. So this is part of the same conversation where you began, this feeling that we have achieved and we have now gone too far. And in fact, this needs to slow down a little bit and go back a little bit. And let me tell you, that is not the case. I mean, even if I compare myself and from my mother's experience to my experience, I am, as much as I am on daily basis, tired because the systems around us hasn't evolved to the level that individuals were supported to evolve. But even if I am tired, I am tired in a good way with so much gratefulness in my heart, knowing that compared to my mother, I own land, I hold a bank account, I know how to keep myself safe from domestic violence, I can travel alone. I mean, these are some of the small luxuries just a single generation ago. Most women across the world, particularly in the Asia Pacific, did not have. I grew up in Sri Lanka and until I came here as a young adult, and I'm a first generation migrant. My exhaustion, I welcome that. And that is a sign that things that are happening around me are my doing, my making. And I will welcome this exhaustion because this moment is hard earned, hard gained, and it can slip down any moment. And this is what the extremely well-funded anti-rights movement is propagating, both in the manosphere and elsewhere. And this is what we need to guard. And this is exactly what the women's rights organizations in the Asia and the Pacific are doing, keeping it real, bringing sense and lived experience to the conversations. So we are not looking at bold strokes, because what we're talking about is affecting individuals every day in real time, in real ways.
Oh, you just said something so powerful, Naomi, about that when you're in the middle of this feminist fight right now, you can think that nothing's changed. You can feel like you're drowning, but it's not the case. Yesterday, I was reading this 1972 essay. It's very famous, by Susan Sontag, and it's about the double standard of aging for women and men. And so this essay, like, you know, I'm about to turn 50. It's a little bit older than me. And it was actually kind of great listening to this essay because I realized how much we have gained. Like the women in her essay were facing a completely different set of circumstances. It was far more unequal for them 50 years ago than it is now. It's not to say we haven't got a ton of work to do. We absolutely do. But we are not judged in the same way. We are not. We do have a lot more voice. We do have a lot more agency. You know, she was talking about how older women can never be seen as sexy. Older women can never marry younger men. There was all this stuff that they couldn't do, which they can do now. So you've got to be able to look back at history as well and say, it's actually not like that anymore. We have made gains despite everything that's ahead of us.
Yes, that's a good reality check to reckon with the costs, but be grateful for what we've got as well.
Yeah.
I'm Justine Toe. It's God Forbid on ABC Radio National, the panel show about contemporary belief. I have here with me CEO of the International Women's Development Agency, Naomi Kanangara, and also journalist, author and broadcaster Ginger Gorman. We're talking about the plight of women here and around the world in 2026. Naomi, can you give us some good news? Where are women winning?
Women has always thrived when we stand together. And we know this historically. Women are who we often turn to in the moments of support, for strength, for wisdom, for our collective power. And that's what we are realizing much more than any time else, is that we need to bring ourselves in a collective, organized way, the power of movements. We need to keep those movements supported, funded, visible, loud, because we know that when it comes to systems change, when it comes to policy change, nothing is more effective, Justine, than the power of feminist movements. And not what type of government is in the power, and not what level of funding is available, not how many women are in the parliament even. So what we see again and again is that when the women as a collective in their own power stand together around an issue that matters in that moment, like we have seen with Me Too, like the Epstein, I feel a lot of hope that the paradigm is actually shifting, and so glad to be a part of that.
I'm wondering, do women have a unique talent for network power? And I'm not saying that this is something like, you know, grounded in the body or whatever, but like you're talking about the power of collective movements, the power of feminist movements, of organizing. It seems like women do kind of kill it when it comes to that, right? Like I'm thinking of the temperance movement in the 19th century. I'm thinking of the kind of like getting rid of slavery movement where all these ladies decided to not have sugar. Of course, it took more than that to get rid of slavery, but that was like quite a big deal as well.
It's funny that we are taught all these soft skills, supposedly soft skills, because they're actually not soft skills, like socializing, listening to each other, supporting each other. They are hard skills in that they make change. So we know better than anybody the power of story, and we tell each other's stories, and the listening to those stories and the platforming of those stories has this kind of viral impact. And this is a very personal story, and I'm only going to tell it briefly, but I became friends with Brittany Higgins because of the cyber hate she was receiving. And her ability to tell her story was so inspiring. And I said to her, it's the younger feminists like you that are actually making change and making older feminists like me able to tell our stories as well. And it's only because of her I then wrote about my own sexual assault and it went viral, you know, and it's because of the bravery of younger feminists in a lot of ways that they are creating a movement, and they are, you know, like the Grace Tames of this world being a difficult woman. You know, that is inspirational. And I see this in my own 15-year-old daughter, Justine. Like her generation, the sexual violence and badly behaving men, they're everywhere. You know, it's awful what they have to put up with. The difference is that they will not put up with it. They instantly call out the behavior. They will say to these guys, like I've seen the text messages my daughter and her friends send to these guys. It's like, shut up. Don't speak like that. And, you know, in the case of one young man who sexually assaulted another young woman quite recently, like the shame that was poured on him from the social group was incredible. And that never happened when I was that age. So they are actually so powerful. They are not putting up with any bullshit, you know, rubbish, and they're making the change. And that is incredible to watch.
That's so good. You know, I'm thinking of this.
I agree.
I will get to you, Naomi, but I just felt like I had to offer in a book recommendation here.
Oh, go for it.
I mean, it's fiction, but it's called The Silence of the Girls, written by Pat Barker. And the last like little slice of it has this extended, like just account of misogyny and how it actually affects everyone. But she's got a line here that made me think instantly of Grace Tame, Brittany Higgins, Chanel Contos. It's like, oh, these fierce young women. And I just felt like I get tingles when I read that because it's true. Like
it's incredible.
The bravery of the young kind of actually gives strength to older people as well.
So this is incredible storytelling happening right here. Two reflections. One is that when you look at the amount of effort that goes into keeping women separated, pitted against each other, keeping our voices minimized, there has to be known power in collective voices of women and the powerful voices of even singular women, because there's so much organized effort going into to reverse that, to minimize that, to quieten that, right? So that's one part of it. And secondly, like you, Ginger, just about to turn 50. I turned 50 recently, last year. I mean, I'm in my 50th year. And that when you reach that kind of milestone, you look back at your own life and then kind of say, oh my goodness, you know, I have a story to tell. And then you begin to understand the same way that you feel that there has so much injustice, discrimination, challenges that has taken place in your life, and you think that is personal, that is, you know, something that happens to you, so do most of other women. They also feel that they can write a book, a novel, a story for what has happened to them. So there is this kind of, A, there is a lot of power in sharing, linking this, and B, what it's revealing to me is that, again, the need to move these stories from personal to systemic.
Can I make two comments just in response to what you said, like the amount of energy that goes into separating and shutting women up. And the book I'm writing at the moment is about older women. And the only explanation for how scorned older women are in every aspect of life and how sidelined, you know, these kind of tropes of being hag and Karen and, you know, the witch trope. And obviously in the modern Middle Ages, hundreds of witches were killed across Europe, witches in inverted commas. It's to do with the threat of power that older women have, because we just stop, you know, our estrogen goes down and our anger goes up and we just stop being willing to take anybody else's rubbish and being told what to do.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm looking forward to my crone era. I really am.
I'm totally inhabiting it now. I'm here for it. I'm just like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not shutting up.
Naomi, tell us about how the IWDA has engaged men and boys. I'd love to hear more about how you've engaged men in these discussions.
Part of the conversation that we are having both locally in Australia and supporting our partners overseas to us is engaging men meaningfully in the work that we do. I mean, for example, the most recent campaign that IWDA had online is about the manosphere. These pockets in the social media space that propagate misogyny, that's part of the work that we do here. But more importantly, at the grassroots level, the challenging of the barriers against keeping women safe, making their engagement meaningful, opening up opportunities, allowing rights to be experienced at the same level as their male colleagues, that is not just a woman's job. Obviously, it's led by very powerful, informed, voiced women, but they do that in allyship with men on the ground. Without the allyship, sustained allyship, informed allyship of men, what we are trying to achieve is challenging unnecessarily. So we count on that, and maybe that's a wish and a hope for not just for this IWD, but for the future ones as well.
Yeah. Ginger, what do you reckon? What role can men play that's not, you know, performative or paternalistic?
I mean, men have a huge role to play. This incident happened to me the other day, and I just want to bring it to mind because I think men have to take responsibility for other men and their part in the change and their part in having a more just and equal society that benefits them as well. So I was in the city, I bumped into this friend of mine, tall, good looking, he'd just been to the gym, let's say in his mid-30s, and these two young teenage boys were smashing into verbally this older woman. And we missed the incident of why that happened. But my friend called those two young men over and he just said, that's not cool. You're not being strong. You're actually being weak by attacking that woman. And, you know, this is, you are actually showing yourselves up to be twits and you're showing disrespect for not her, but for me and all men. Like, he just went for it. And wow. It was quite amazing to me. And, you know, the fact that my friend was good looking and fit would have made these two young men mortified. Yeah,
pay attention.
So fascinating.
Yeah.
And I was like, it wasn't perfect. It was over in a couple of minutes. But I was like, wow, that's actually feminism and social justice in action, because those two young boys looked mortified. And my friend said to them, don't do that again. Don't ever do that again. And they walked off. And I was like, I don't think they will ever do that again. So, you know, challenging sexism and harmful behavior of other men is an incredibly powerful tool. And also, men just need to share the load. Sharing the load at home is not just about respect for your partner. It means you get to know your children. There's lots of evidence from the Nordic countries that men that spend more time with their children, you know, have different bonds with their children. It's about men being able to take up policies in the workplace which give them time at home. You know, they can use their power to change systems and they can center women's safety and see it as beneficial, not just to women, but to their own children and to themselves.
Yeah. And I really should say shout out to my husband who rearranged his workday so I could come and do this show.
Well, thanks, husband.
Thanks, husband.
What's his name?
Vaughn. What a hero.
Thanks, Vaughn. Yeah, thanks. We love you, Vaughn. Good job.
Now, oh my gosh, we've been having such a great time, but I've been asked to give you the final question to both of you. I want you to imagine that you're the guest speaker at an event full of young people about to launch into their lives, okay? And I want to know, what do you tell them about how to hold realism and hope together?
Do you want to go first, Naomi?
No, you go first.
Okay, so I would say hope and realism aren't opposites. You need both. And you need to use your energy and your courage and your anger to make change, to look at the world clearly, and don't confuse broken systems with a broken future. So I just want to clearly, quickly mention this research I've done at the Global Institute of Women's Leadership at the ANU through an eSafety grant, just to show this kind of structural changes that we can make if we have the energy and the anger. So we've been working on online abuse at work, gendered online abuse at work, and we found essentially that in workplaces that have really rigid masculine norms, women cop far more gendered online abuse at work. And so that's a structural problem, right? It's among many. But then we've designed the tools to make the change, okay? So policies, prevention, checklists, all of that stuff. Because gendered cyber abuse and, in fact, gendered violence is not random. It happens in systems that protect male entitlement. So the thing is, hope is structural change, and it's also practice. It's not a mood. It's something you choose when things are hard, and it's something you put work and energy into. So surround yourself by people who want to expand your courage and not your fear, and be the change that you want to see.
Oh my gosh, Ginger.
I like to be in that audience. That's beautiful.
What would you say, Naomi? How to hold realism and hope together?
So for hope, I would ask the audience to look back and look at what the women who came before us have done in circumstances that had zero hope. We can vote. We can own bank accounts. We can walk to work. We can have some level of bodily autonomy. It's because of the hope that our sisters carried for us when none should have been carried in extremely dire circumstances. So I'm very grateful, and I would take that as my guidance, the way that I hold hope for the future in this moment of darkness. That's for the hope. And for realism, I would tell anybody that do not let anybody else define what's real for you. I mean, we are in a system where we're being told what is right, what is wrong, what is real. Our boundaries are set most of the time by others. And this is the moment to push those boundaries, create a different reality that fits, that creates justice, that brings hope. And I say that the work that our sisters who came before us have done is brought us to this moment that we can define our own reality and carry hope to the future.
Oh, I love that. I love that. But that is so powerful to look at what the women did before us.
Here we go.
Because a lot of times they were the first women as well. No one had given them a template. We have a template now.
Yeah, that's right. We're standing on the shoulders of giants. My gosh. Yes. And with that, we've reached the end of God Forbid. Thanks so much to our guests, CEO of the International Women's Development Agency, Naomi Kanangara, and journalist, author, and broadcaster, Ginger Gorman. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on, both of you.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks for having.
You can follow and share God Forbid on ABC Listen and find all the details about the show and our guests on the God Forbid webpage. Email us at godforbid@abc.net.au. And thanks to producer Amanda Roberts and sound engineer Craig Tillmouth. What a legend. I'm Justine Toe. James is going to be back next week. Until then, remember to be good, or shall I say, be difficult. This has been God Forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.